With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 31st. Happy Memorial Day to those of you here in the States. 2021, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And before we dive into this week's show, I do want to thank those of you who continue to support the show and ensure that it will always remain 100% free to download. You can support the show in a lot of different ways. You can rate and review it on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or you know any podcast manager that you use. You can shop in the Talk Nerdy store, or you can visit patreon.com/talknerdy and pledge your support on an episode-by-episode basis. This week's top supporters include Mary Neva, Brian Holden, Christopher Pitts, Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Dudas Infinitas, June Sapara, Pasquale Gelati, Ulrika Hagman, sorry, Ulrika, Elise Christie, and Robert Christ. I was just flying through that. Visit patreon.com/talknerdy if you are interested in hearing your name at the top of the show. All right, this week I had the opportunity to chat with Heather Montgomery. She previously worked, actually developed and directed the McDowell Environmental Center, where, you know, her degrees in biology and environmental education, you know, led her to this life of teaching kids all about the world around us. Now she's a full-time writer, and she's written just like buku, like so many children's books about all sorts of fun, different topics. But this week we're going to talk about her newest book, which is called Who Gives a Poop? Surprising Science from One End to the Other. And yeah, I know you're listening to the show. You're probably not a kid. I'm not a kid, really. I'm a big kid, and I think poop is funny and interesting and important. And also, maybe those of you who are listening have your own little ones. But even if you don't, I think that this episode will be relevant to all of you. So without any further ado, here she is, Heather Montgomery. Well, Heather, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Yay. Okay. So we're going to talk about your new book, Who Gives a Poop? Surprising Science from One End to the Other. And I have to tell you, when this came across my desk, I was like, well, duh. I don't know how we could not want to sit down and talk about poop. But in full disclosure, this is not a kid's show. I consider myself a big kid, and I think that a lot of my listeners do as well. So I know that we are fundamentally interested in this, even though we are not kids. But also, a lot of my listeners have kids. And so I thought, you know, it's not very often that we get to talk about science education, how we talk about science with children, what children know, what they don't know, how do we answer their burning questions. And I don't know, I think there's a lot of cool psychology in approaching how we talk about this stuff with kiddos. So I hope you're comfortable if we go there a little bit today.
Oh, I'm ready. I hope you're ready for some fecal fun, because there is so much to dive into. I mean, literally dive into. The thing is, we're all curious about it. We're taught to not show that curiosity. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a tragedy, really, because as adults, when we stifle our curiosity, we miss out on really important questions and topics that can help us kind of move the conversation forward.
Yeah. And you know what I think is so funny? So
I have really close friends who have three little ones. So one of them just turned five, one of them is three, and the other one is an infant still. She's like 6 months, I think. And, you know, the two little ones are, you know, the older one is working on, he's potty trained clearly, but he's working on not having nighttime accidents. And the middle one is like wearing daytime underwear, but still nighttime diapers. And it's really funny and fun to see how candid they are about their poop and pee and about when they have to go and when they don't have to go and how proud they are about pooping. And yet there's this weird thing where we teach our kids, yay, poop, you poop, let's talk about poop. And 2 seconds later, it's like, this is very taboo. We don't talk about this in public.
Right?
It's confusing.
It's very confusing. And I mean, it's a shame because there's potential everywhere in this stuff. You know, the thing is, when we're taught that about a lot of topics, and I've just discovered that it's really valuable to turn into these things that are either tragic or difficult or gross, things that we're taught not to talk about. It happened before, earlier, with a book I wrote about roadkill, which, again, another kind of taboo. You don't talk about that, especially not to young people. It's just too sad, right? But when we actually look at this stuff, there's so much to learn and so much to teach us. And that's, I didn't start as a writer. That was never my intention. But when I kind of discovered this way to reach discussions that I wanted to have, it just opened me up and shocked me, honestly. I didn't know I could go there.
and you know, so as you mentioned, you didn't start off as a writer, but you have been an educator for, you know, most of your career. Is that true?
That's right. I started with a BS in biology, which was awesome because I love anything that's alive. But after working in the lab for a while, I discovered that wasn't enough for me. And so I went on, I got a master's degree in environmental education, and I directed a residential environmental center where school groups would come and we'd spend 3 days or 5 days out in the woods, you know, up to our knees in the creek, hiking up the canyons, canoeing. And we were exploring, but I could only reach a certain number of kids. And so later in life, I kind of fell into this idea of writing. Honestly, what happened is my husband and I would often go to bookstores. And when it was time to go, he'd always find me in the kids' book section. And he'd ask me, Heather, you know, what are you doing here? And I was like, we don't have children. So he was like, are you buying gifts? I'm like, it's just where the best books are. And I was like, oh, you know, I've always been a reader. I've always loved to read, but I didn't discover the joy of writing until I had gray hair. And that's kind of sad. So I love to talk to schools now about that fact. Like, I love to go and show kids that research is awesome. I mean, it is what I love to do. Like, I love to be curious and stir into things. And that's what my job is now, right? My job is to ask those questions that really kind of wiggle me somewhere inside, right? And like kind of turn my heart sideways and actually spend time trying to find answers. And then mostly I don't find answers, but that in itself turns out to be an answer.
Yeah. And so this is actually your, let me see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, sixth book?
Well, officially it's my 16th, but.
Oh, wow.
So I write in two segments. Mm-hmm. One is the educational books.
Right.
So those are books that I'm given an assignment. And mm-hmm. those are also for children. And then there are my books that are my projects in the trade market. So yes. And I have one more coming this fall called What's in Your Pocket? Collecting Nature's Treasures. It's a little picture book. So much fun. And yeah, another one that is in the works. So.
Oh, I love that so much. And of course, in this book, this is so fun. You have some emails back and forth with some individuals about poop. You have a lot of really beautiful illustrations. And the illustrator of your book, Iris Gottlieb, gosh, did a really beautiful job. These are so much fun. And you really dig deep into some, you know, fundamental and important science.
Yeah, you know, I used to write books that are about a topic, and I discovered with my previous book, Something Rotten, A Fresh Look at Roadkill, I discovered that it's so much fun to show kids the process of science and the process of writing. One time an editor actually sent a rejection letter to me, and I learned from it. She said, "Heather's writing reminds me of Mary Roach for middle grade." I was like, "Who's that?" I don't know if you're familiar with Mary Roach's work.
Oh,
but,
my gosh, yes. We love Mary Roach on
the show. She does amazing books for adults, and I had never read her work. And I was like, "I'm not Mary Roach. I'm Heather Montgomery, da-da-da," you know, and I just, like, blew that off for a while. 6 months later, I'm like, maybe I should figure out who this Mary Roach is. What's she write like? So I picked up Stiff, The Curious Life of the Cadaver. Oh, my goodness. Just phenomenal.
Yeah, one of my favorite books.
Right? Yeah. So she says, the question is, what happens if I donate my body to science? What actually happens? What actually happens? And so for folks who aren't familiar with the book, each chapter is basically her going in and investigating a situation. So, for example, you know, we assume it's in medical schools they use it. Yes, but they also use it to study facelifts. They also use it for crash test dummies. They have dummies, right? But they need real bodies too. And so what's interesting to me was that she showed the process as a researcher and as a curious person. And that's how I figured out how to write like this. Like, why not show the kids? I mean, to me, the research is the fun part. So why not show them? Like, yes, I go all the way to New York City to meet an endangered species out in the wilds. Like, that just, that's a weird thing, right? And it's a rat. Like, who wants to go meet a rat? I didn't want to meet a rat, but then I fell in love with it, right? I mean, they were just amazing, these little beautiful creatures. Yeah.
So I'm wondering how you approach a book about poop. You know, you start, I mean, obviously the topic is really broad. It has, you know, there's so many different ways you can go. It's fundamentally fascinating. And because it has that sort of, unfortunately, taboo quality, I think that there's a lot of, you know, potential and a lot of fun. But how do you go about organizing your thoughts and really ultimately organizing the book in a way that kids, it's not just going to grab them and be interesting to them, but it's going to help them learn?
That's always the challenge. The structure of the book is always the challenge. But I decided early on that this would be a narrative. And I knew it was kind of my journey into this process. So finding the narrative arc was the challenge, but the research wasn't a challenge. So I just dive in. My question kind of became, who uses poop? And so I just started looking at all the different types of folks who use feces for different reasons. And I just started investigating them. And I do a lot of personal investigation because as a person who loves wildlife, I'm always squatting down, stirring and scat. Like, that's just what I do. Like, I have all these questions. So often, as I'm looking at wildlife scat, a question that I can't answer arises. And so then I pursue that. And so I just keep pursuing these questions through scientific journals, through articles, through interviews with scientists, through going, joining them in the field. And I'm always looking for what is the bigger picture story here, right? What is the bigger message, the bigger piece that I can learn from this? And honestly, in this book, I didn't find it till after I had written the entire book.
Okay.
I submitted my first draft and I hated it. I mean, absolutely hate it. I did it. Because, you know, I'm one of those people who's going to follow the deadline. I'm going to meet the deadline and all of that. My editor was so confident. She kept saying, "It's fine. You'll find it. You'll find it." I'm like, "No, it's not there. It's just a bunch of mess. It's just literally a bunch of crap." And I couldn't stand it. And then a week later, I have an interview that, well, it didn't happen early on because I couldn't get the interview. And it was an interview with a man at a landfill who, honestly, they didn't want to give me the interview because they had dealt with so much journalistic nightmares and bad PR that they didn't want to give it. So, you know, 6 months later, they were willing to grant me this interview, and it totally changed the book. I mean, it didn't actually change the content. It changed the sequence, and it changed the conclusion of the book. It changed my own growth. And that was amazing. That taught me a lot about the writing process, that I have to kind of just trust inquiry that it's okay just to ask the questions and follow them. And sure, I'm sifting through the whole time, like I'm asking questions and some I don't follow and some I do follow, but that I just have to keep going, that there is growth in any topic that I look at. There is learning. You know, I'm going to discover something worthwhile, no matter what it is, if I just keep going. And it turned out, you know, the book was about my own personal bias. And I couldn't see that when I was so enmeshed in the material. But interestingly, the threads of that story were all there. I just didn't see them.
So tell me, what was this big kind of insight that you came to? You know, we've kind of talked around it. What specifically mm-hmm. was it that you realized sort of after that first draft that helped you to iterate?
I never wanted this book to be about human poop. Like, mm-hmm. it's just too gross, right? Like, I had no interest in it. Like, that is not my, I'm an animal girl. And I just wanted the whole book to be about these surprising stories. You know, the guy who turns dog doo into fuel to light a street lamp. I mean, that's just amazing, right? The scientists who take animal dung and stop poachers, I mean, elephant dung, you know, and learn to stop poachers because they track it. Like, these were amazing things to me. But these human poo stories kept popping up, like the one with the Lego heads, which was awesome. Scientists wanted to know, like, what happens if you swallow a foreign object and, like, how long does it take to go through? And of course, getting permission to actually study that on people, it's kind of hard. So they studied it on themselves and they took the little teeny heads off of the little Lego people and they each swallowed one. You know, and watched it. I mean, like, that is just funny, right? Yeah. And then they made a Twitter campaign about it, right? But in the process, I had these poops, human poop stories popping up. And one was about a train load of feces, human feces, that had found its way from New York and New Jersey and was stuck in a little town in Alabama, Parrish, Alabama.
A train load?
An entire, like, there were 56 train cars.
Full. Why? Why would, what? Why?
So, right? Exactly. That's exactly. And all of the news outlets were going there. And I'm like, oh gosh, I have to know what's going on because this is my state. But also I used to live near there. And so I tracked
Wait, what's
on
your
down
state?
There.
Alabama?
Alabama. Yes.
Mm, gotcha.
Alabama. Mm-hmm. And I trekked on down there. And little town of Parrish, I had to ask my way, you know, at the gas station, and the guy nods his head and sends me down the street and sniffing my way to this train. And it's literally true. These train cars were just sitting there in the little rail yard, just waiting. And what had happened is the train was supposed to be unloaded at the next stop. But there was a little paperwork holdup. The folks of the next town had decided, no, they did not want these feces offloaded in their town and trekking through their tramp town on trucks. The feces was on its way to a landfill.
Okay.
And so it basically got delayed for months and months and months in this little town, literally in people's backyards, right across the street from the neighborhood. Yeah, right. And I was mad. You know, I got to talk to the town mayor. I got to talk to a neighbor right there who was dealing with this and unsure about whether he should plant his garden because of what was floating in the air. And, you know, when I left that town, I was pretty upset. And again, it had just reinforced the idea that, you know, human poo is bad. But I wanted to know where it was going. And I wanted to see what they were doing with it. And that's the landfill that I didn't get an interview with for a long time. And when I finally did, you know, I walked in there and this man started to give me a tour. And as you can imagine, there was some distance between us. And as we toured, I saw the brilliance of what they'd done. Because the landfill was actually in an old coal mine. This part of the state has just been, you know, coal mines are very common. And when the coal mine is reclaimed, the surface soil is put back, but it's dead. It's literally sterile because it's been sitting in a pile and losing its nutrients. They're all leached out. The bacteria is gone. The organic matter is just dissipated. And so what would happen is they would put it back, but it was really hard to grow anything because they need to cover up the landfill, right? And he was having a real issue with water quality because the water running off of that surface, he couldn't get plants to grow, and he needed organic matter. And so what he'd basically done is gotten these shipments of feces and used them as fecal transplants, basically as using them as fertilizer to re-nitrify the soil, put in all that fertilizer that it needed. And so when I walked out there with him, and we stood on a ridge and overlooked one area that was this reclaimed coal mine where 30-year-old trees were just bush high. You know, they were just scrubby. And there were hardly any trees on it. And then we turned the other direction on the other side of the slope where it was just lush vegetation. But the moment that really made it happen was when we walked down that slope together and we stood underneath a wild plum tree and we picked plums right off of that tree and shared them. And it was just this moment where these two people who kind of came from, you know, other sides of the fence, and this idea where, you know, I little country town in Alabama versus big city in New York, wait, we could actually come together and see that there is that this thing that was seen as a problem all of a sudden was a solution. And to me, that's like the core of the book is this idea. Yeah.
So I have a couple questions for you because things come up for me as you tell me this.
Sure.
Number one, where did they get all this poop?
It's all treated biosolids.
Okay. So they got it from like a plant?
Yeah, so they're all waste, the waste plant where they treat the material. Now, there is some question about the grade of the biosolids because grade A is the most treated, right? And grade B is lesser treated, and then grade C is hardly any treated at all.
That would be like almost like just pooping
sludge.
In the woods.
Sludge.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Basically. Now, the interesting thing is if you go to your home improvement store and buy, you know, topsoil, quote unquote, it probably includes these biosolids as well.
So does it include, because that's really the question for me that I was confused about is and maybe this is a wives' tale or maybe this is just something that stuck in my mind, but I was always under the impression that, for example, if you are a person who keeps compost, that you shouldn't put things like cat or dog poop in your compost, and you definitely shouldn't put human poop in your compost, but that other like wild animal scat is sort of less dangerous.
So
where did that come from?
There's a lot of questions in that. And I wouldn't say that I am the person to answer it for sure. A lot of it depends on your willingness, you know, for risk, but also like what you're using the compost for.
Okay.
So, and how you treat your compost. So some compost is managed in a way so that, that the temperature does rise high enough to kill certain bacteria, right? It's not going to kill everything. But for example, I visited a compost pile once where they composted deer bodies off the road, right? And the compost coming out was cleaner than the deer and the wood chips that went in.
Right, okay.
Because of the process of the heating. Now, when we talk about feces, we're talking about more than just the bacteria. We're also considering about parasites, right? And so some parasites can insist and therefore survive. For example, there's a story in Who Gives a Poop about the raccoon roundworm. And certain ones can survive amazingly well under different conditions. So there are systems for composting feces, and that's in fact what the waste treatment plant does. But there are smaller systems for, you know, households. But you'd want to know, you'd want to have the right system.
I see. So the poop in the trains was intended. It was treated and intended to go and help basically fertilize the landfill, like to introduce some of the necessary bacteria to help break things down. But unfortunately, it was
stuck.
It was stuck.
Yeah. And that was a terrible situation. You know, it was not fair to that town. And there was a lot of challenges with that. But interestingly to me is I had jumped to the assumption that they were just filling Alabama's landfills with somebody else's feces.
Right, like they had scooped it out of the toilet and put it straight in the train.
Right. I mean, there is a problem. You know, we have a large quantity of waste in our systems, in our cities, and unfortunately, we haven't figured out good ways to handle that. Actually, another story that didn't end up in the book was this great story of the scientist who was studying how fast different mammals go and the average rate at which they go and things like that. And it seems like a silly thing. You know, she literally would videotape animals doing number two and then time it. And she averages it out.
So not how fast it takes from the time you eat to the time it leaves your body, how fast the actual process
exactly
of pooing is.
Exactly.
Okay, yeah.
Sorry. And so it was, you know, it seems like this silly thing, right? She wrote a scientific paper and all this, and it got a lot of press. But it's way more than just a silly story about, you know, how fast you go. Because what she's really doing is she's understanding how different systems work. And even large mammals and small mammals were, in fact, going at about the same rate. And if we can study, her idea is that we need to study these animals' bodies because they are processing vast amounts of material in order for us to understand different ways to handle our own cities' systems, to use them as an analogy. And you know, it makes a lot of sense. You know, animals have been on this planet and the nature takes its course, right? And things balance out. I think it's a pretty important thing for us to do is to consider we need to turn to nature to understand how to make things work.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, just it's this weird paradox when it comes to things like poop or things like sex or, you know, these different things that kind of we have constructed societally. And you see this varies, obviously, clearly from society to society, but we have constructed some sort of idea of what is acceptable to talk about and what is polite and what is taboo. Yet, I think in making something taboo, there's also this backlash effect where we want to know more about it. So like you said, the scientist who published this study about how quickly animals poop got a ton of press around it, probably fundamentally just because it was about poop.
Exactly. In fact, another story. So a scientist used that to his advantage. He studies knee replacements and he couldn't get any press for his papers. He had a genuine concern with the process with which they were studying the knee joint attachment to the bone. And so what he did, because his papers weren't getting the press that they needed, is he took some dinosaur feces, coprolites, and he used those to prove the point that you could attach this to anything if you did it this way. And it was just amazing because, yeah, he got a lot of press all of a sudden and people started paying attention. And it's important because, well, I know a lot of folks, including my aunt, who just had a knee replacement, and we want to make sure we're using the right material. And it was this great story of how we're willing to, you know, read this story because it uses dinosaur poop versus, you know, if it just used the regular material, we wouldn't pay attention at all.
I have so many friends who work as science writers and they tell me all the time, like, I think the trifecta is a story about dinosaurs having sex in space. And if it says something about whether or not chocolate is good or bad for you, you know, there's like certain things that it's like, they know for a fact, unfortunately, that if that ends up in the news cycle, people are going to read it. And I think, yeah, I mean, poop really interests, it really interests people. And I think part of it is because, again, we're not really supposed to talk about it. We're not really allowed to talk about it. But of course, in your book, you talk about it and you go there. I'm wondering, are there any specific stories that as you were researching your book, you came across that, A, like really surprised you, or B, you were just like, oh my gosh, this is so important. I just want to shout it from the rooftops. I feel like the world has to know this.
Yes. I think all of them. the story of my growth, I think, was the biggest surprising, deepest surprise, right? I went into this book thinking, you know, I'm going to tell all these really cool, fun animal poop stories and it's going to be awesome. And I originally thought that the book was about the potential, right? The power of poop, right? And how powerful. And I thought that was the big story, but the big story really was like, whoa, Heather, you've got this bias that human stuff is bad. And yes, we've done all kinds of things to this planet, but wait, we've done a lot of good too. And to me, resoundingly, that is the story that I want to tell. That I care an awful lot about animals and I care an awful lot about the earth, but it doesn't mean people are bad. And I think it's easy. The thing is, it's so easy for us to make things black and white, and they're not. And in the book, I just kept hitting these stories that I wanted, you know, I want to tell things to young people in a way that they understand. So I thought that I had to make it black and white. I had thought we had to have a, this is right and this is wrong. You know, there's a story about whales and their power to change the ocean and how they're eating at the bottom of the ocean, lower in the water column, and then they're pooping at the top, right? And that nutrient, then we now believe, this is a relatively new study, that then it provides all this nutrient. Well, I wanted to just say, yes, this is what it is. But the scientist, Dr. Joe Roman, I was talking to, he says, wait, no, this is not a yes or no. This doesn't mean that I know this is true. This is my hypothesis. And I'm gathering data in my data show that there's evidence for this. But in science, that's not what it's about. And so this was a great opportunity for me to show young people this, but also to remind myself of this, that life is gray, right? Life is in between these two extremes. And often, particularly for young people, we try to simplify things into right, wrong, black, white. But that leads us down some roads we don't want to go, right? Where we grow up thinking that there are these two sides of a coin, when in fact, most of our understanding of the world is that there's all of this in-between world land. And so every time I would come to that, it would hit me that this is an important story to tell, that if we help young people as they grow, not, you know, elementary, young children, but as they're learning to think abstractly, if we help them to see that there are so many variables involved in every question, every problem, then they'll grow up to be good critical thinkers.
Right.
And that's really my goal, is to help us have citizens who can really think.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
And what an important and foundational goal it is, and how cool that you get to use your writing as sort of a conduit to help establish this and to help reinforce this. I think, too, it goes to show, not only is there this bigger picture question of critical thinking, of the ability to weigh evidence, of the ability to think logically and to, you know, hypothesis test and to be, you know, develop as good skeptics. But I do think that we're at a precipice right now, as you were talking about this gray area, this black and white, this human beings are either good or bad, especially when we're looking at environmental devastation, especially when we're looking at the detrimental effects of anthropogenic climate change, that there's almost, not almost, an actual existential angst that is being developed, especially in very young children, where they've been born into a world in which they feel helpless, and in which they feel a very real amount of despair because the world around them is in peril. And to grow up only hearing those incredibly negative messages that are almost cynical, without hope, and without promotion or reinforcement that we can affect change, that we are empowered to affect change, and that as human beings who, yes, have done some pretty bad things to our planet, we also are innovative enough and have the ingenuity to undo and to even do and to even proactively do better things for our planet. It's such an important message, and I worry that little kids are growing up like really anxious and stressed about this.
And there's actually some research about that. One of the things as an environmental educator I've always felt strongly about is that we have to allow kids the opportunity to love the world before we put this burden on their shoulders, right? And I feel like often we place it on their shoulders too young. And so I feel all of my picture books, I try to make about the glory of discovery and the wonder and awe of nature. And even in these books, I kind of call these my fresh look books because I think we take a fresh look at something that, you know, is gross or top tragic or something. I can't not end with hope. Honestly, I can't handle that myself, right? I have to have hope. And I do have hope for the world. But I want to show kids that, you know what, we're discovering new species every day. You know what, we have young people who are doing amazing things all the time. I want to show them that their curiosity, their questions will take them places. And it's quite an honor to get to do this kind of work, you know?
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about that sort of hope specifically with regards to Who Gives a Poop. You know, what are some of the really hopeful stories that you're able to tell in the book? What are some of the things that you came across that are like, wow, this is so cool when it comes to poop, like this is how the world is being changed?
Well, I love the story about Doggy Doo Doo and street lamps. So this guy, Brian Harper, in England, he lived in a town where there were these amazing antique gas street lamps, but there was no gas to fuel them. And Brian is a tinkerer, and he has an underground lab, literally. And he noticed how much waste was being left in little baggies along his street, because people would walk up his street to this track where they would walk their dogs. And knowing that, you know, fuel, that's fuel right there. It could be fuel that bacteria can consume the waste and turn into methane. He hunkered down in his lab and he designed a way to turn that poop into power. So now people literally come to his street so that they can walk his dog to use this, and they dump the doggy doo in a bin and they crank it, and the bacteria consume the waste, and they create methane. It pipes it up to the top, and every night the automatic ignition lights it, and it is just amazing. Other cities are coming to view his system because dog parks obviously want this. What an awesome thing. Brian is now working on a grill where you could grill your hot dogs over fuel. Not sure I want to go there yet, but why not, right? It's perfectly clean. It's just this amazing idea that we've taken things that were a problem. Number one, waste sitting on the surface of the earth. Number two, waste that went into a landfill and caused problems where there's methane, right? And number three, the fact that there was fuel that was needed. And instead of digging up coal, for example, and burning it to then create electricity to light our street lamps, why not do this win-win-win situation, right? Where we've taken it and we've used what was right there. I love that story so much. And it also just gets to show, just goes to show that like a single person who wants to solve a problem can. It took him a while. You know, it was not an easy thing. But if we just keep working at it, we've got the materials, we've got the smarts. We just need to put the pieces together in a way that makes sense. And that's exactly what I hope to inspire in young people.
I
They're
love
the tinkerers,
that.
You know, yeah. In the future. Yeah.
Oh, for sure. And they approach problems with such creative eyes because they're not constrained yet by everything that we've learned as adults you can't do. So they always have these really innovative approaches to problems, young people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If we just will give them the opportunity. You know, one of the things that I see happens a lot is we restrict kids. And it's actually the genesis of my next book. When I'm outside with children and they want to pick stuff up, often we don't let them because it's dirty, right? Kids want to collect stuff and often they're not allowed to. They want to squirrel it away under their bed, right? They want to dig through all those rocks that they've picked up and nuts and make a mess with them. That's exactly what they need to do because all the great scientists, they were those curious kids. I started seeing in biographies of scientists, one little scene that would catch my attention. And the scene was always when the kid would kind of get in trouble for bringing stuff like that inside. And I was like, wait, do they all do that? And so I started asking scientists, and hands down, they almost all were that kid that brought in all kinds of stuff and made a mess in their house. But what they really were doing is they were learning to observe. They were learning to classify. They were learning to sort. And those things help them notice patterns. And it's in noticing patterns where we can actually make discoveries. And so I think it's so powerful to give kids the opportunity for nature play, to play with that stuff, because that's what's going to generate their ability to see things that are different. You know, there was a six-year-old who was hanging out in a museum where his parents worked. Well, he looks over in this big container of specimens that were all juveniles. They were all larvae, mantis shrimps, okay? He asked his mom why one of them was different. She's like, wait, what? That six-year-old discovered a juvenile, a larva, that the adults had totally not noticed. And honestly, mantis shrimp are these really cool shrimp that kind of do this kickboxing move. You might have read about them, where they have this really powerful punch and that's how they knock things out. But we don't really know who their larvae are. Like, there's many species of mantis shrimp, but we've not matched the juveniles to the adults. And we haven't even, like, identified all the different juveniles. So this young boy actually, there were four different juveniles in there that he recognized. And the adults hadn't even noticed. And so he got to name them things like balloon larva and gnome hat larva. And like, how cool is that for a six-year-old to do that? Because he was willing to ask the question and notice the things that were different. Just, yeah, it's pretty awesome when a kid does that.
I love that. Yeah. I love that. Right. So, you know, obviously the point of the show is not to tell every story in the book because we want people to get out and read it themselves. But I'm wondering if before we wrap it up and before we get to the close of the show with my final two questions, if there's anything that we didn't touch on that you feel like, you know, you definitely want to make sure people know.
There's a lot I want to share. There's so much here. I think I definitely want people to know that when you go looking into something like this, you're going to find things that shock you. Obviously, I'm dealing with feces, so I make sure to tell kids this right up front. This is not something you do at home, right? This is something that I am trained in how to handle. But I would go and dissect feces, like actually dig into it. And the beauty that was inside, even me, I mean, like, I am such a nature lover. You know, you wouldn't be surprised that I'm like nerding out on this stuff. But my jaw would drop because a crayfish's antenna is exquisite under a microscope. And I didn't even know that. And I've been looking at crayfish for years and years and years. So I want to encourage people just to stop and look at stuff. Really look, because the wonder is there. Sometimes we're just not opening our eyes enough to see it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's beautiful, beautiful advice. And on that note, Heather, I'm wondering if you are open to answering the same two questions that I ask all my guests who come on the show, the big picture closing questions of Talk Nerdy.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
All right. So here we go. When you think about the future in whatever context is, you know, relevant to you right now, it could be personal, it could be global, it could even be cosmic. I'm wondering, number one, what is the thing that's really keeping you up at night, that's driving you, that's concerning you deeply, maybe even existentially? And on the flip side of that, what are you, you know, authentically looking forward to? What are you actually hopeful about?
The thing that concerns me is that I think we've forgotten how to listen and have a discussion about a topic that troubles us. We often jump right into the blame, right into the argument, right into the banter, and that's no way to solve problems. That's no way to come together. On the flip side, it's kids. Children are amazing. Children, they don't see the barriers that we see, right? We have created these biases. We have these barriers that we put between groups of people, and they're not there. They're really not there. They're just something that we adults have created as a society. And the beautiful thing is, a kid doesn't see that, and kids just play. And as they play together, they learn together, they grow to know each other. And honestly, those friendships, they solve the problems of all these barriers that we've put between each other. And so they are my hope for the future.
And you, of course, know that better than most because of the incredible work that you do. Well, Heather, thank you so much for spending some time with us today. The book is Who Gives a Poop? Surprising Science from One End to the Other. Heather, thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. I so much enjoyed it.
And everyone listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.